solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Play to Potential. So for me, the typical dichotomy that I have seen in myself or with clients or other leaders and people is, particularly in the professional life, is people get caught up with the idea of exploring professional potential, right? It's all about, you know, I want to do this because what if I have the potential to generate this business? What if I have the potential to run whole of Asia? What if I have the... So there is all of that. It's very focused on professional potential, and there's nothing wrong with that by itself. However, where it gets in the way is we confuse that with our life potential, with our human potential. What is this human life about, and what is possible in human life? What is even the purpose of human life? And in that, is simply pursuing professional potential and professional success the only thing that matters, or is there something bigger and larger than that? You know, what about, as we were talking about, you know, our own sort of this work on self-realization, on self-actualization, the work on becoming more self-aware, the work on deepening the quality of unconditional love we have for others, at the least with our family members, right? We say we want to love them unconditionally, but do we love our family members unconditionally? And how do we value the progress on that versus, you know, growing my business 2x. Like, who has decided which is more important, right? Or whether we have the gumption and the courage to pursue our life purpose, right? What is the value attached to that? Or our spiritual growth, or self-responsibility, or contribution to society, or, you know, climate change, or whatever it may be.
Welcome to the 84th Conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman, and this podcast is a labor of love for the long term, where I have conversations with leading practitioners, thinkers, authors, artists, sportsmen, and other leading professionals to decode insights around three themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. In addition to curating this podcast, I work with leaders with a growth mindset as a trusted sounding board, helping them and their organizations transform and play to their unique potential. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the advisory work I do, you could just visit playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. As we approach the end of 2021, do look out for our end of year episode, where we've handpicked and curated 10 most impactful nuggets from 2021. This includes insights from people as diverse as Tenzin Priyadarshi, a monk from MIT Center of Ethics, Ramesh Srinivasan, a senior partner in McKinsey, Bruce Feiler, the author of the book Life is in the Transitions, Amy Edmondson of Harvard on psychological safety, and Lloyd Reeb of the Halftime Institute, talking about how we all can become our own chief life officer. This episode should be out in a couple of weeks. Back to the current episode. I'm really excited to bring this conversation with Rajiv Vij, an experienced executive coach based in Singapore, and the author of the recent book, Inside Out Leadership. 16 Radical Insights, Successful Leaders Wished They'd Discovered Sooner. Rajiv doesn't know this, but he has been a role model to me as I was making some of my choices from Egon Zehnder to the coaching and sounding board advisory work that I do now. I remember speaking to him at the cusp of launching into my journey and remember some of his advice very vividly. While there are a lot of books out there on leadership, I really liked Rajiv's book because of the nuance with which he unpacks some of the themes. I specifically loved his insights around how leaders should think about delegation, mindfulness, being open to possibilities, multiple levels of listening, and the notion of working with the leader as a whole when he engages as a coach. Without further ado, let's dive into a conversation with Rajiv Vij. Rajiv, thank you for taking the time for the Play to Potential podcast. Excited to have you.
No, totally my pleasure, Deepak. I've been looking forward to this conversation.
Rajiv, congratulations on the recently published book, Inside Out Leadership. How's the book doing?
It's coming along nicely. I think I'm getting lots of positive feedback, early days, but I think it's connecting with leaders as well as other professionals. And I think they're getting some new and different insights from it. So it's a slow read in the sense that people like to read kind of one chapter at a time. There's lots to absorb. There are some exercises at the end of it. So I think people are sort of taking their time. And so I haven't had a lot of feedback yet. But whatever I've had has been very encouraging.
Lovely. Congratulations, Rajiv. And would love to sort of dig into the book in a few minutes. But before that, I do talk to people about their journeys and some of the key choices on this podcast. So maybe we start there and then get to the book, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, sure.
Rewinding the clock, Rajiv, you were on a good wicket in Franklin Templeton a few years back. You grew the assets under management from $180 million to $3.6 billion in 3 years when you took on the role in India. Then you went on to lead the Asia business and grew the AUM fourfold. But then around the time you quit to pursue a different path. Can you take us back to that passage of play and relive some of the thoughts, emotions, and tribulations during those months?
Yeah, thanks, Deepak. Yeah. You know, I was very fortunate to grow quite rapidly in the organization and at a relatively young age as well. And I don't know if it had to do with that or just my own inner journey. But somewhere in that process of growth, I started to become acutely aware of a sense of incompleteness within me. That something, despite all this success, something was still missing. And it was hard to articulate exactly what. And I remember telling my wife for the first time about it, and she was like, wow, what's wrong with you? You know, like you've got, you know, you look at the typical list of things you want to be accomplishing in life, and you tick all the boxes, and, you know, what's happening? But it stayed with me, this little disturbance. And around that time, I got involved with some NGOs in my personal capacity. Just through some friends and acquaintances. And as I started to spend more time with these individuals, some of the leaders there, it really inspired me very differently. It really got me thinking that this high-flying job that I have, the jumping in and out of planes that I'm doing every week, kind of what difference does it make? You know, does my existence even matter? Will I leave this world any better than what I had, you know, inherited? And I guess many of us have these questions at some point in our life on that long flight or on a beach holiday and so on. But, you know, come Monday morning and we get sucked into the emails and the calls and so on, and the spark's gone. But for me, it stayed with me. It really hounded me. And I was also at that time reading a lot about, you know, in the space of who am I, purpose of my life, social change, and all these sort of existential questions. And as my friends often remind me, I was going through perhaps some kind of midlife crisis, and perhaps rightly so, but I think it was getting channelized in a very sort of positive way. I'd also learned some meditation techniques, now way back like 25 years ago, and found them really effective personally, even professionally. But again, with a busy corporate life, you know, these things were the remnants of my day, things you love to do, but you don't end up doing enough of. And around that time, because I felt torn and conflicted, confused, I revived it. And wherever I was traveling around the world, I would find my time to meditate every single day. Long story short, Deepak, what was coming through to me was, while work was terribly exciting, but the joy of being involved in two things. One, of working on myself, on my own personal and to some extent spiritual growth. And secondly, of helping others in some way. At that time, it was through in a very sort of minuscule way through these NGOs that I was getting involved with. But it gave me a sense of meaning that I could get from helping others. And that started a bit of a hobby horse that, you know, this is the life I want to create. And that's how I kind of made the switch.
And maybe going back to the switch, as you say, Rajiv, you know, when I work with leaders in transition, you often have multiple pathways to choose from, you know, in terms of how you scratch that itch. How did you, can you talk a little bit about the different pathways you considered and the one you ended up picking, the one you ended up walking on
as you transition from the busy corporate life?
Yeah. So, you know, once this hobby horse had got into my head, right, which was all about, I want to create a life which revolves around working on my own personal and spiritual growth and helping others in some way, right? That was kind of the banner, sort of the North Star that I was working towards. And then there were many ideas cropping in my head. And by the way, this is all happening while I'm busy in my, you know, corporate role, et cetera, et cetera. But I was like, should I introduce new forms of holistic leadership to organizations? Or should I start an NGO or get into wellness? There were many ideas coming through, but somewhere in that search, research and ideation, I actually stumbled into the field of coaching. And as I start, I mean, I don't remember exactly the book I read about it, or first I saw it on the internet and I got interested. But as I started to learn and read more about it, it just fired my imagination. It was like, wow, this is it. This is what I was meant to do in this lifetime. You know, it's like that deep connect where you have the sense that this is your calling, you know, where your whole sense of purpose that you want your life to be about can get totally aligned to what you want to do professionally. So it's not like you're trying to live your purpose, but, you know, in those 10 hours a day, you are not exactly aligned to that. For me, this was just back, you know, because I figured that for me, coaching offered such a wonderful platform. Firstly, it's about helping others. That's the primary sort of objective of what you're trying to do. So I knew that's what will give me that sense of meaning and so forth, which perhaps to some extent I was seeking. And secondly, it is a space where you, by the very nature of the work you're doing, you are going to continue to work on yourself, right? Because you can't be coaching others if you are not walking the talk or you're not sort of trying to grow yourself in your thinking and just in a holistic way. So it just seemed like meant for me, you know, kind of thing. And then once this idea started getting crystallized, then I couldn't hold myself back. Then it wasn't, you know, one day, a few more years, I'll be financially more secure. You know, kids were young. My kids were 11 and 4 at that time. But it was the call was so strong in my mind. And I do, I'm a left brain analytical kind of a person, but I didn't do any analysis. I didn't speak to another coach in the world. I didn't figure out, does it sort of work economically? Nothing. It was just like, this is what I want to do. And if the call was so strong, then I just, you know, decided. I still remember talking to my leader in San Francisco saying, you know, this is what I want to do. And they, of course, took a long time to even reconcile, like, what's happening, you know, like this sort of fast-paced, you know, successful executive, etc. And they, in fact, offered me a very interesting proposition. They said, why don't you keep your role Monday to Thursday? Same comp, same title, everything stays the same. But Friday, Saturday, Sunday, for the next 12 months, you're free to try this crazy hobby of yours and see where it goes. I guess somewhere hoping that I'll get over this itch. And I mean, you know, very tempting, obviously. But I thought about it for a while and then I passed it. And I think that was such a wise decision in hindsight, because it really, you know, the shift I was trying to make, Deepak, wasn't a career shift. It was a life shift that I was making, right? And in that life, I didn't want to create time for maximizing stuff on all fronts, right? And I knew that on a Friday afternoon when career office calls with the crisis, I'm not going to be able to say, hey, I'm on my off time right now. It doesn't work that way. So I moved on and all I can say is, you know, this has just been a blessing for me, you know, both professionally and personally. It's just been wonderful.
That's wonderful, Rajiv. I love the way you frame it. Apart from helping others, it's also an opportunity to sort of be on an endless pursuit of working on yourself, which is so incredibly rewarding. Reflect on the journey with the podcast, for example. You know, I tell people first and foremost, it's an L&D function for me, right? Even if nobody listened to it, just the privilege of speaking to people like you and learning from some of these conversations is worth the investment, and everything else is a bonus on top. So it's wonderful that you frame it that way.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. You know, I started writing, Deepak, primarily with the objective of saying, okay, you know, I want to reach out to more people because my, you know, I want to keep my coaching practice a bit tight, et cetera, et cetera. So how can I, you know, help other people benefit from some of these learnings and so on and so forth. But the biggest gainer of my writing, as I've now discovered, is me.
Hmm.
Because writing forces me to crystallize some vague ideas. And particularly when I'm writing a blog, for example, you know, 600-700 words, it forces me to clarify my own mind, you know, from all these vague ideas that you have. You, by and large, you know what you're trying to do or what you want to say, etc. But, you know, writing the piece really helps me. So I've been a big gainer, and I'm glad you see the podcast journey in the same light as well.
Hmm. If I may persist with this transition for a couple of minutes, Rajiv, one of the things that comes up, you know, when sometimes leaders have to make this dramatic shift from a busy corporate life to a path like the one you've chosen, is sort of the attitude towards money, right? I find that it's a key part of the equation. What have you learned, whether it's your journey or some of the leaders you've worked with? Is there any perspective around how we should think about the economics or the mindset with which we need to approach the economics when we are at these transition points?
I think that's a very pertinent question, Deepak, because it comes up all the time when people are trying to make the shift or considering the shift. I think a couple of points here. One is that I think, particularly for people who are successful, I think, you know, we realize that actually after a point, success does not add to greater happiness. And it's somewhat the same with money, right? I mean, you need obviously a certain quality of life, certain, you know, you want to make a living, you want to send your, you know, children to right schools, et cetera, et cetera. But an unending pursuit of money does not add to our quality of life, whether it's our fulfillment or happiness and so on. So one is, I think, that perspective that, you know, we need to recognize how much is enough. And there is a broader shift that happened to me naturally during that time, which is the distinction between needs and wants.
Hmm.
You know, I always wanted, you know, I was fortunate, as I said, to grow every 2-3 years, I would get promoted, et cetera, et cetera. You're moving to the bigger house, bigger car, and, you know, the latest cell phone, whatever. But do I need that? Not necessarily. And I think somewhere deep down to me, that was coming through, that bunch of things which I'm pursuing, which have become my wants and almost to some extent even an addiction. Do I need that? Do I need the next big house? Do I need the next big car? And I figured I don't. And when I look at what I need to be happy, even financially, is not that lot, is not that much. So I think recognizing how much do we need in our own personal context, and in our family context, firstly, that's important. So that automatically, or there's a good chance that's going to reduce, you know, your whole financial constraint in the first place.
Hmm.
The second thing I've seen with experience is letting go of future financial growth is actually not that challenging. So which means if you were on an upward trajectory financially or in your career, et cetera, and you're saying, you know what, I'm getting off this this treadmill and I'm willing to give up the future sort of earning potential. That part is okay. What I've seen in with a lot of clients, et cetera, as well, is if they are able to exit and pretty much maintain the lifestyle they were exiting at. Not the mm-hmm. future lifestyle, not the potential lifestyle,
mm.
but the lifestyle they were at the point of exit. If they can maintain that, then I think they are generally very happy because now they are pursuing things that are meaningful. They add to, you know, meaning and fulfillment and happiness and balance and bunch of other things. So the holistic outcome is actually very healthy. But in case it's a situation where that exit is going to lead to a decline in your sort of quality of life, just from a financial standpoint, then I think you have to think a little bit more carefully about it, because you yourself, who's, you know, passionate about something, et cetera, and want to make this call, might be okay. But invariably, people also have other people in their ecosystem, right? There's a spouse, a kid, et cetera. And then it becomes a bit of a challenge to be managed, because you're kind of, you know, you're kind of disrupting other people's sort of life as well. So you may be okay to sleep on a mattress, but it's not always fair to expect everyone around you to do the same.
Very
interesting. So I think those are the 2-3 perspectives I've seen.
Very interesting. I love the distinction between, solving for, you know, or maintaining the state, the sort of the quality of life, if you will, at the point of exit versus forsaking the upside. I like that nuance, Rajiv. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. I'm reminded of an earlier conversation at the podcast with Prakash Iyer, who's a fellow alumnus of IIM Ahmedabad, who was last the country head of Kimberly Clark Lever, and now he's a speaker, an author, and a coach. And he narrates a story about Joseph Heller, the author of the book Catch-22.
Like a lot of other kids coming out of middle-class India, financial goals were important in the early stage of our lives. And therefore, you know, it was important for you to kind of make enough bread and butter and some jam. But beyond that, I guess I've been swayed by this guy. You know, there's this interesting story of how Joseph Heller apparently was at this party thrown by an investment banker in New York.
This is the guy who wrote Catch-22.
That's right.
Yeah.
And Joseph Heller was, you know, but a friend of his took him along and said, come, it's a great party. You'll meet all the who's who of the city. And as he went there, it was a great evening, lots of crystal, the finest wine. And as Joseph Heller stood sipping a drink, his friend said, you know, do you realize that our host, the investment banker, probably makes more money in a day than you do, than you have in a lifetime? And Joseph Heller said, you know, that's probably true. But you know something? I have something he'll never have. And the friend says, what? And Joseph Heller says, enough. And that's a story that's kind of stayed with me. And in a sense, I think I spent the last few years of my life saying, hey, I think I need to learn to say enough. And the minute I know I have enough, you're sorted.
Right.
You don't really need to worry about it. And then you're free to go and do what you want to do.
Personally, I found knowing the enough point tremendously liberating in pursuing what I enjoy and at the pace at which I enjoy life. I also like the distinction Rajiv makes about foregoing future upside versus taking a hit on the current lifestyle. Taking a cut on the current lifestyle does raise the bar quite a bit on how much one needs to align with all the key actors in our life. The other related point to mention here is that while we speak about financial abundance or scarcity, it's worth thinking about time abundance or scarcity concurrently. One of my earlier guests, Ashley Willens of Harvard Business School, speaks about the notion of time poverty and says that when we are short on time, we experience a certain unhappiness which is similar to financial poverty. She says quite eloquently that we often focus on time value of money, but we don't pause to consider the money value of time. Bringing time into the economics might sometimes make the decision easier and the proposition easier to navigate with the key stakeholders around us. If this is of interest, you might want to tune into my conversation with Ashley Willens. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Rajiv Vij. Back to your journey as a coach, Rajiv, you say you've been at this for 15 years. I remember speaking to you maybe a decade back or so when I was at Egon Zehnder and I was probably evaluating some of these choices. What, if you look at your journey post having made that switch to what you do now, are there, would you sort of call out some of the key choices you've made, what you've said no to maybe as well, apart from what you've said yes to in the path that you've chosen?
Oh, loads of choices, actually. I think that's been one of my biggest sort of learnings as well, that if you want to say yes to a few things, you have to be willing to say no to many things. And I think part of it, I've been fortunate that sense of purpose and that sort of North Star banner that I was talking about, that has been so clear to me that every dilemma and decision gets sort of bounced around against that. So if it's something that's going to support me in my own personal journey of, you know, growth, etc., I'll explore it. If it's going to allow me to help others in a meaningful way, I'll explore that. But to give you a sense, so and that's where I think, you know, and you may have that experience too, Deepak, in your personal journey as well as with many of your clients, is that, you know, when you're trying to do the right thing, the universe does conspire to help you, to support you in that journey. So I had a bunch of choices I made at the start. One was, for example, that I'm going to coach people across Asia, but I don't wish to travel for work because I didn't like traveling for work. And maybe I traveled too much in those days. And so I said, I'll coach people over the phone. This is even before Zoom and everything else, right? So it's old fashioned phone. And initially, you know, my clients were a bit skeptical, like, how will this work? This is such an intimate personal conversation, et cetera, et cetera. And how will this work over the phone? But that's how I designed it. That's how I'm going to create my life, right? And that worked beautifully well. I also decided that I'm going to have coaching for fixed number of hours in a day, right? So I don't have a coaching session before 10 in the morning or after 4 in the evening. That's kind of my discipline from day one. And it started actually with the premise because 4 o'clock, my kids used to come home from school and I wanted to stop then and, you know, spend quality time with them, et cetera, et cetera. But that's been my discipline for the last 15 years. And I've worked with clients, you know, across Asia, lots in India, of course, you know, Europe and US and so on. It always fits into the 10 to 4 because when you are clear, and I'm not being tough or rude or anything like that to a client, but it, they appreciate that you're trying to sort of walk the talk yourself. I also wanted to keep my practice tight. You know, with this 10 to 4, obviously, there are only so many clients I can work with. And I've had so many approaches, you know, even friends ask me, listen, you want to help more people? Why don't you create an Asia-wide coaching organization, right? You want to help people. That's your stated objective. So why don't you do that? And I have resisted that simply because I know that my ability to help others is directly proportional to my ability to help myself. And not in a selfish way, but it's like when I meditate and when I'm more present, I know I'm a better coach. So I need to create the time to be in the best place I can be. And for that, I recognize that if I created a Asia-wide coaching organization, I'll become a managing partner and I'll be back to, you know, running the organization. And it's not going to be necessarily as. So in many cases, I've let go of the idea that more is better. It's keeping as pure to your intent as possible, right? So, I mean, the idea that, you know, you earn good karma, not from how many people you help, but with what intent are you coaching your clients every day? If you can keep that intent clear, then that's a healthier place. So many things like that I have, you know, I had, of course, you know, opportunities to be on boards of companies, on, you know, on NGO boards, et cetera, et cetera. And I've, you know, after the first couple of years, I let go of all of that because I just found that my ability to, even with NGOs, for example, right? So 15% of my coaching hours are reserved for leaders of NGOs. And all of that work, I find is so rewarding because particularly working with small, mid-sized NGO leaders, the work I do with them and when they work through their own challenges, et cetera, it actually trickles down into the entire organization because these are small, mid-sized organizations, right? So rather than being on the board of that NGO, I feel I'm able to contribute more and in a way that is more fulfilling for me as well by coaching the founder. So many choices, but they've all been, I mean, I just feel thankful for sticking to those.
Very interesting. Rajiv, if it's okay with you, would love to move to the book Inside Out Leadership and maybe discuss some of the themes that really struck me as I was reading the book. Rajiv, you say that when you work with a leader, you ask the sponsoring organization to allow you to work with the leader as a whole. Can you talk a little bit about why you say this and how you know, how that impacts your approach and how it impacts the leader rather that you work with?
Yeah, it's a crucial point for me, Deepak, and I'm glad you picked it because, you know, I find that at leadership positions, you cannot differentiate between professional effectiveness and personal effectiveness. Who you are fundamentally begins to come through very quickly, right? So, I mean, it happens at all levels, But in leadership positions, you're obviously more visible, you're in the spotlight. So all of these little traits get amplified a lot. So whether you're insecure or courageous, whether you're aggressive or permissive, you know, whether you're trustworthy or manipulative, and so on. And so if you want to be a greater leader, you have to be willing to invest on looking within, working on your inner self, in fact, almost reforming your inner self, because it's the work you do with your inner self that eventually reflects in the quality of your external leadership. And this is the fundamental belief based on which I approach, you know, when organizations talk to me about coaching, I always highlight this and say, you know, please allow me to work with the leader as a whole person, because their professional success, their leadership success, which is what they are eventually after, is very closely intertwined with their personal effectiveness and who they are. So, you know, with, again, all these traits and so forth. So just working with leaders at all levels of their being, you know, in terms of their physical habits, you know, emotional makeup, their, you know, mindset, their beliefs, all of that is such a crucial part of how they show up as a leader. So, and they all, the organizations, they all sort of, you know, agree to that and value that. And I think the leaders find that part more than, you know, learning to be more strategic or, you know, or grow my business in a certain way, et cetera, et cetera. The richness of the conversation comes from almost this whole personal being, because, and also not to forget that this work then not only translates into their becoming greater leaders, but equally it affects their personal relationships. It impacts their sense of balance, happiness, fulfillment, and so forth. So they just find themselves in such a better place at the end of these conversations. So I think that to me is really at the sort of the pillar of, you know, this work.
And to expand on that, Rajiv, when you say that you engage with the leader as a whole, what does that mean? If you could break that down a little bit in terms of the kinds of things you do or the kinds of conversations you have or the reflections that you guide the leader through, could you shine the light on that?
So this is quite crucial, Deepak, because it's the work they do in different aspects of their being, which eventually translates into that leadership. And I still remember this client of mine, for example, in Japan, and his regional head had suggested to me that, you know, he's a fantastic individual doing a great job, et cetera, but one of the things, one of the real sort of challenges is interpersonal skills. Now, if I had approached this person and talked about interpersonal skills, I don't know how that would go. I mean, many times leaders then tend to be defensive and so on. But I said, listen, let's see, what are your pain points? What's bothering you in life? And let's work through that, knowing fully well that whatever comes up is eventually going to help him become a better leader. As we were talking in the conversation somewhere, you know, this person, we came up with one goal, two goals. We were still sort of, what else, what else? And this issue had not come up at all. And as we were talking, then this individual said that, you know, there's one other thing, and I don't think you can help me with that. But I said, like, what's that? And he said, you know, sometimes I feel I'm not a good human being. And I said, like, what makes you say that? He said, no, just conversations with me don't end well. And so now, so we call this goal a better human being. Now, at one level, you could argue a goal like that sounds such a personal goal, right? What has that got to do with leadership? But we all can see that working through that whole idea actually helped this leader to enhance on all of those interpersonal and other skills as we went through the journey. Or another example, maybe if I'm talking to a leader, let's say the feedback is, oh, this leader needs to be more strategic, for example, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. We're talking and I say, like, what are you struggling with? Anything that you wish to change in your life, et cetera. And they say, you know, I just feel overwhelmed. I think, you know, I'm very stressed and so on and so forth. So it's okay. So what do you want to work on? Maybe life under control or a calmer me or something like that, which again, if I describe it to you or HR, it'll sound like a very personal goal, right? Like calmer me, like, okay. But the thing is that the journey to that calmer me or to life under control revolves around, you know, learning to be more strategic. Because one of the reasons I may be stressed or overwhelmed is because I don't delegate enough. I get too involved in the operational details. Maybe I don't have enough interest outside of work, and so on and so forth. So there are a bunch of things that may come up which are solutions to help reduce the stress or feel like life is under control, but actually indirectly they are all going to help this person become more strategic as well. So that's where I'm saying that the leadership effectiveness will anyway happen once leaders can sort out, you know, their emotional, mental, and other traits that might be holding them back.
And in that context, Rajiv, you speak about three different quotients, right? IQ, EQ, and SQ. I guess a lot of us understand IQ and EQ intuitively, but I was curious about SQ. You call it the spiritual quotient. Can you expand on what you have in mind when you say that? And also, you call it the last bastion of leadership. If you could talk a little bit around why you say that.
Yeah. So the idea of spiritual quotient, not to be confused with anything religious or anywhere even near that, is really around the whole notion of being a more self-actualized leader, where the leader is, so there are sort of three components of the sort of spiritual quotient. One is self-awareness, where the leader is highly self-aware and highly self-aware at all levels of their being, right? At the physical level, understanding their habits, where they're spending time and why. At the emotional level, having a deep understanding of, you know, their own varying emotional states, what makes them happy, sad, anxious, excited, etc., and why, and how that affects how they relate with others. At the mental level, having a deeper understanding of their own, you know, thoughts and attitudes and perceptions, and most importantly, their beliefs, which are guiding, you know, their own life experience. And at the spiritual level as well, having a deeper understanding of who are we, you know, at the essence of our being. So that's one, the self-awareness piece. And then there is the whole piece of purpose, which is, you know, having clarity of their own life purpose, not just what, you know, organizational purpose, but their life purpose and how that feeds into their professional life and how that eventually connects with what the organization is trying to do. And the third piece is self-responsibility, which is being very mindful of all our thoughts and actions and taking responsibility for those and recognizing that whatever thoughts and actions we have, how they impact the entire ecosystem, right? I mean, one of the big learnings of COVID is also, or a reminder, not even, is the interdependence, right? Everything is connected in this world. Mm-hmm. And so when leaders take decisions which are, you know, useful for the well-being of their team members or the team members' families, or they take decisions which have impact on climate change and so on and so forth, right? Just being very thoughtful and taking responsibility of all those actions and decisions which are impacting the entire ecosystem. So in summary, the whole idea of the spiritual quotient is someone who's highly evolved as a leader. So, you know, the thing is that why I say the last bastion is because IQ, the intelligence, is obviously, you know, crucial, and the belief used to be that the smartest person should be the leader. EQ was the idea that, you know, you need to be emotionally attuned to yourself and to others, because only then you'll be able to inspire other people to, you know, greater results. But the point is, like, I think where we are on the planet in terms of leadership and what's expected and what's required, you know, the old ideas of management and leadership are not yielding are not meeting the needs of society in its holistic sense. And that's where you need leaders who are holistic, who are, you know, self-aware, are purposeful, take personal responsibility, etc., because that's what's going to be so sorely required if we want to move to a better world.
And staying with that, Rajiv, if one had to work on their spiritual quotient, what sorts of suggest that we embark on this journey of sort of upping our spiritual quotient along those three or four dimensions that you called out?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, it's a lot of hard work, and it's a consistent effort. You know, it's a lifetime project. Let's put it that way. Having said that, I think one of the first things that leaders can do, which I would say that most of us in today's society and even some of the good leaders don't end up doing enough of, and that is to create a structured and regular reflective practice. You know, where we create moments of solitude on a daily basis, where we cut ourselves away from the noise of the social media and Netflix and, you know, the cell phone and so on and so forth, and create moments where we can start to look within, where we can start to connect with our inner self, because and become a self-observer, because that's when we can begin to see our own recurring emotional mental patterns, many of which are quite futile, but are still guiding our everyday life. And we can begin the work of reforming them eventually. But the first big part is just becoming self-aware, right? And that deeper self-awareness is also going to eventually lead to greater self-responsibility. It will also show us clarity about our life purpose, et cetera, et cetera. But it all begins with this thing of creating time for reflection. So I think that's the crucial bit, would be a place to start.
Moving to, a related theme, right? Journaling is one thing that you talk about. And you make an interesting point in the book. You say that while journaling, we should not be judging ourselves or thoughts or feelings. What exactly do you mean by that? And, what's the nuance here?
Yeah. Great point. I'm glad you picked this sort of nuance here. It's a little sort of tricky space. So here is the thing, there are various techniques to reflect: meditation, journaling, positive affirmations, visualization, bunch of different ideas. But when we look at journaling, and it's quite true for meditation as well, but let's pick on journaling. The idea is that what we need to develop when we talk of developing self-awareness, we need to develop non-judgmental self-awareness. And why I say that? So for example, you recognize, let's say you're journaling and you recognize routinely that you are, lately you've been very irritable, or lately you've been feeling a bit down, or lately you've been a bit envious, whatever that feeling may be, right? Now, so that's a feeling that we want to become aware of, right? But the moment, what is our natural tendency though? We all tend to judge ourselves because, and I'll come back to the point, we judge ourselves because there is a sense of incompleteness, inadequacy within us. And we are constantly trying to fill that void, and that's why we are judging, are we on track, are we not on track, and so forth. And it's that judgmental nature which forces us automatically to judge others as well, which we do all the time, including our, loved ones, our kids, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes things worse. So when we are talking about journaling or meditation and non-judgmental awareness, the idea is that, let's say you recognize that envy and the sadness and the irritability. If we judge it and we say, why do I feel like that? What's wrong with me? I'm not a good person. How could I be envious? Or I talk about being a coach. How could I be feeling sad? I thought I was, in the business of happiness, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think is going to happen to you? Do you think you're going to feel better or worse? Hmm. Clearly, you're going to feel worse. And what you're doing is, it's like your child, Deepak, who walks in and says, hypothetically, I'm in middle school and, these two kids in my class, they are such bullies and they're so rude and this, that, and the other, and kids don't like me and all that kind of stuff. Now, what are you going to do? You want to reassure your child, right? You want to sit them down and say, no, it's okay. It's totally fine. Kids are kids and they do different things, but you are a wonderful person and you're so good in so many ways and so on and so forth. But when we are just thinking that, I have been sad, we are not reassuring ourselves. We are actually making it worse. It's like telling the child that, how could you do that? How could people not like you? What's wrong with you? That's just making it worse. So I think the starting point of all meditation and journaling and things like that is to create a non-judgmental space, because that is what is going to create greater self-acceptance, greater self-love. And all of that is actually automatically going to heal us from that void of the sense of inadequacy and incompleteness. Because we start to then accept ourselves for who we are. And it's okay. And that doesn't also mean, Deepak, because the other typical sort of challenge there is, oh, if I'm being like that and everything is fine, then, you know, will I become complacent? And it's not that. We all have the drive to get better and we will keep getting better. But it's just that oftentimes we are trying to get better from a place of inadequacy. That only if I get better will I be complete. And my point is, no, you are already whole, complete and enough the way you are and where you are right now at this very instant, every single human being. And we want to get better. So that's the reason why this non-judgmental self-awareness is crucial, because the judgmental part makes is the thinking mind which makes things worse. If we can subdue that, then slowly we become aware, yeah, I've been sad last few days, and that's okay. That sadness is going to pass. It will pass, like every feeling. The excitement and the joy will also pass, and so will the sadness and the irritability. Both will pass if we don't engage with it. If we engage with it, it will grow. Did I answer your question?
Makes a lot of sense, Rajiv. I was just sort of processing it. You know, one of the people I spoke to at the podcast was a lady called Tasha Urick, who's done a lot of work around this notion of self-awareness, you know, the internal and the external self-awareness in terms of how others see us. And she actually says, you know, while journaling, she suggests that we use the what question rather than the why question. She says the what keeps us grounded on the facts, you know, what happened. The why often takes us to a place of judgment. I'm just sort of connecting it with what you just said. But it's interesting that you also link it to this notion of adequacy and sort of growth from a place of contentment and adequacy rather than a place of fear and insecurity and inadequacy. That's an interesting nuance.
Yeah, because, you know, the thing is that no amount of self-improvement is going to help unless we develop self-acceptance. Because you will improve, but as you know, and I know from our lives and our constant pursuit of growth, is that you climb the next hill and then you, before you settle down, you're looking at the next one, because we can always keep growing in whatever field. Maybe earlier we were trying to do it in a corporate ladder and a financial and, you know, other ways. Now it may be the ladder of self-growth, but still we can get caught up in the same sort of routine, same vicious cycle. That is never enough.
And earlier, it's an interesting, sorry.
Yeah. No,
it's
no, no.
It's an interesting paradigm. Because if I link it back to a term that was used when I was in McKinsey, you know, there was this phrase, insecure overachievers, to a lot of the consultants, right? And what you're actually saying is, you know, let's decouple the two. Let's not, insecurity is not a prerequisite for achievement or growth. Right, it's actually maybe counterproductive to the other side.
Yeah, exactly. So then we follow what we deeply what our heart and soul desire. So we are able to express ourselves more fully when we are in that state.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman. Something similar came up in my conversation with Tasha Urick, a leading self-awareness researcher who's written the book Insight. She's spoken to hundreds of leaders on their self-awareness practices. She speaks about the risk of us falling down the rabbit hole of rumination and discusses that here.
I knew that we would find that the more people introspected, the better off they'd be. And that was the opposite of what our data showed. So we found that people who self-reflected often were more anxious, more stressed, more depressed, less satisfied with their jobs and their relationships. They were even less in control of their lives. And we're just sitting there going, oh my gosh, maybe self-awareness is bad, right? Maybe delusion is actually what we want to be fostering, because this doesn't seem like it makes sense. And as we started to dig into some of the data, we started to discover that thankfully, it's not that introspection in and of itself is bad. It's just that the way most of us introspect is completely wrong. And the best way to illustrate this, you know, again, without having 2 hours to delve into it, is to think about probably what the most common introspective question is for most people, which is the question, why? So we might be trying to understand why we're in a bad mood. You know, you could say, why am I so upset after that conversation with my coworker? Or we might be trying to understand a bad outcome. You know, like, why didn't I get that promotion? Or we might be even trying to understand why we believe what we believe. You know, why do I want that promotion? But as it turns out, those questions, not only do they lead us away from true insight about ourselves, they give us a false sense of confidence about our knowledge. So, for example, Sigmund Freud was wrong. He believed in his work that people could access their unconscious, right? So like, really, why am I upset? If I just excavate, if I just think long and hard and ask that why question, I can find the answer. But what research has shown for, you know, decades actually, is that no matter how hard we try, we can't access so many of those things. It's what I mentioned earlier about the behavior and emotion and knowledge blindness. Mm-hmm. So what happens is we find an answer that feels true, even if it's wrong. So that's an example of where it can lead us away from the truth rather than towards it. Another reason why is a really dangerous question, introspectively, is it has been shown over and over and over to depress us. You know, you think about it, like, why didn't I get that promotion? If you're not careful, you can start asking questions where the answers are, well, because I'm just a fundamentally bad person and who would want to promote me? And you can kind of get stuck in, I call it the rabbit hole of rumination. And so what we wanted to do in our study was understand, okay, if why is the wrong question, what is the right question? You know, what are these unicorns doing differently than the rest of us? And it took us a little while to find this pattern, but we discovered that when unicorns introspected, they almost never asked why questions. They asked what questions. And at first I thought like, oh, that's just a weird sort of fluke or a weird nuance. But as we started to look into it, it started to make a huge amount of sense. So one example would be, you know, going back to the question, why didn't I get that promotion? Mm-hmm. Unicorns, if they were in that situation, wouldn't ask themselves that question. Here's some questions they might have asked instead. What did I learn that can help me be better positioned in the future? Or what can I do to close the gap between, you know, where I thought I was and where I need to be? Or what support can I enlist from the people around me to help me, you know, achieve this goal the next time I set it? Or, you know, going back to why am I so upset about that conversation with my coworker? They might instead ask, well, what part of that situation did I own? Or what can I do differently in the future to avoid that kind of conversation with that person? And so what we found was asking what instead of why really helps us avoid so many of the pitfalls of introspection, where we, you know, we're excavating for the truth that we're never going to find, and we're focusing on our problems and feeling victimized and disempowered. So I think what I loved about that is it's a really tangible tool that I think we can take away. It seems subtle, but the difference is just huge. And I'm speaking from personal experience as I've started to use that as well.
Back to what Rajiv says, focusing on the what ensures that we stay focused on the facts rather than getting too judgmental and going down the rabbit hole of rumination. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Rajiv Vij. Changing tracks, Rajiv, you also talk about delegation. And I liked one of the things you say, where you say that, I quote, leaders who are exceptional at delegation don't just delegate what they can't do. They do only those things that no one else can. Can you bring this to life for us with an anecdote or two?
Yeah, I think, you know, the basic premise here, Deepak, is that typically for leaders or, you know, any executive, when work flows to them, like whether it's a new idea, new strategy, you know, new, you know, whatever, innovation, product, technology, whatever, the tendency is that, okay, let me grapple with it. Let me see how we can do it. And then I'll divvy it up to some of my team members, et cetera, et cetera. And invariably the tendency is to jump into the work. And then when you know, sooner or later realize that, you know, it's you can't do everything.
then you start delegating it to others. So it's like what, that's what I say, that you delegate what you can't do, not from a capability point of view, but literally from a bandwidth point of view. Because, you know, you can, hopefully most leaders can do what their team members are doing quite well as well, except for some very specialist skills. But the smart leaders that I've seen, what they do is that they, anything that they are starting or coming to them, or, you know, external, internal, their instinct is, who in my team can do this? Who's best suited for this idea? Whether it's innovation, technology, you know, external networking, talking to the government, whatever the thing may be, their instinct is to engage someone else. And only if there is something that nobody in their team can do because it's something either so crucial or, you know, only their presence is required, et cetera, will they get involved with. And that's the whole sort of the paradigm, that good leaders delegate what they can't do, which is in terms of time. But the great leaders do only that which nobody else in their team can do. So as a result, what it does is it does two things. One is it is hugely empowering for team members. And equally, it actually creates the space and the time and bandwidth for the leaders to engage with the most important things. Because the other paradigm is that, you know, managers do things right, right? We all, as we grow in our careers, we get so obsessed with this being Mr. Miss Reliable, you know, and that creates this whole perfectionism, et cetera, which is a great trait, you know, when you're junior middle management. But when you get to leadership positions, it actually is dilutive. And so managers do things right, but leaders do the right things, as in they focus on the most important. So when they delegate so aggressively, so ruthlessly, that's when they create the time for engaging with the most important. So that's what leads to huge, huge effectiveness. So their thing is, again, just to bring some more detail into it, let's say it's like, you know, every time people get called for a meeting, and you try and attend that meeting. And we know in corporate life, maybe a third of meetings, you know, we are thinking, hey, why am I here? Right? Like, did we really need this meeting? But this leader is going to start by saying, do we need this meeting? If the answer is yes, do I need to attend this meeting? Maybe I'll send somebody else from my team. Why do I have to? What is so crucial? Just because it's protocol? No, that's not good enough. Do I need to, I mean, will I add value, or can my deputy add equal value? If he or she can do it, then let them attend. Even if the answer to that is now, yes, you still need to attend because it's really, really important for you, then the question is, do I need to attend it now? As in when the meeting is being called, or, you know, if I'm busy, can I push it away? So it's in the light of both empowerment and aggressively protecting their time that great leaders, you know, sort of follow this kind of a principle. So. Yeah.
And moving to a different theme, Rajiv, I also like the way you break down executive presence. You know, it's often a very nebulous term, and people don't flesh it out. But you talk about four elements: gravitas, credibility, quality of communication, and appearance. Can you talk a little bit about what these terms mean, especially gravitas, which often ends up being a term that's often used, but people don't exactly say what they mean when they say gravitas.
I know. Yeah, a lot of people get this feedback, but then they're so fuzzy and like, what exactly do you want me to do? Right? So I would put it this way. I think 2-3 key features of each of these words. I would say gravitas is really firstly around being calm, you know, emotionally sort of in a calm place within. Being assertive, so you're not neither aggressive nor permissive, you're, you know, assertive, being very thoughtful, and most importantly, being secure within. So being in a place where you are really comfortable with yourself, comfortable in your skin, because the more you are in that place, more you are in that sort of state, the more your presence is going to grow. You know, you just that sense of security draws people into you. So that's on gravitas. Credibility, I would say, the starting point is, of course, authenticity, right? I mean, if you're not authentic, nobody's going to sort of trust or believe you. So authenticity is important. Being direct is important, because when we are not direct, even though we may be trying to
you know, massage the message and so forth. But actually how we get experienced by others is as we are manipulative, even though that's not our intention. You know, we are only trying to, sometimes we have to give a tough message and we are trying to soften it, right? But the other person is, because if you are direct, they get it. You know, being direct actually makes the assumption that you're talking to an emotionally and mentally balanced adult. That's the assumption, right? The moment we believe that, oh, this person may get hurt, he or she is very sensitive, et cetera, we are already diluting what we are thinking about them. And then we are trying to say things in a massaged way, and which is what then, you know, loses the directness and the credibility. And of course, openness as well. Again, you know, being very open and again, not sort of whether it's hiding facts or just even hiding our emotions. You know, I mean, leaders, as we all know, we've grown up in with that, is many a times would hide their emotions, right? I mean, it's putting a certain brave face was believed to be so crucial. It's now that, you know, everyone is beginning to appreciate the whole sort of mental well-being and, you know, how leaders themselves, besides employees, are carrying so many of these insecurities and so on and so forth, and it's affecting them emotionally. And just being open and sharing about it, you know, willing to be vulnerable. That's what makes you credible. And that's what creates trust. Communication, I mean, a lot can be said on that, but very specifically, I would say the two, three things is, one is being direct again. And besides that, two things. One is being able to tailor make your comments to the audience, and which requires being perceptive. So people with high executive presence are very perceptive. They can read the room very well. And which is why then they can tailor make their comments to suit the audience. And again, not in a manipulative way, but so that it lands well, it connects with the audience. And the other piece of communication is succinct. You know, very brevity is I would say quite a important thing if you want to build that presence as well. And appearance, of course, you know, it's not about being the you know, sharpest looking person in the room, but really about looking and dressing appropriately to the occasion, right? So that, you know, you're not not aligned in any way to the environment. So I would say those are some of the pieces which can help people build presence.
And of the various things you said, Rajiv, if I were to ask you to expand on one word, authenticity, what does that word mean to you?
I would say it's being true to yourself, you know, in your expression. So one is being true to yourself within, in how you are feeling, you know, in yourself. And the other is how you are expressing yourself. So how you are going to be experienced by others as a result of that. So being true to, you know, who you are. That's what I would say.
Got it. Rajiv, moving on, you talk about three levels of listening, which I found interesting. You speak about level one being what the person is saying, level two being how the other person is feeling, and level three being how you are feeling. Can you expand on this? You know, I found... you know, once again, you laying it out in a structure, very helpful. How does one build the muscle to listen across all these levels?
Yeah. I think, so just to clarify the three levels. So one is what you're saying, right? So let's say you are saying you made a hurtful comment, right? So that's what I'm hearing. And so that's one level of listening. I'm only reacting to or picking up only what you are saying. The other is I am empathetically listening and understanding, you know, you made a hurtful comment. Where is it coming from? Oh, you must be feeling frustrated about that issue, or maybe you're feeling let down, or, you know, so now I'm being really empathetic and trying to engage in my mind on the feelings that you are experiencing, which are leading you to say what you're saying, right? So that's the next level. The final level, which is pretty hard, but quite powerful, is understanding what's going on within me. So when you made a hurtful comment and now I'm saying, oh, you know, maybe you got hurt about something, maybe I let you down in some way or something, what's going on within me? Maybe I'm feeling frustrated, maybe I'm feeling angry, or maybe I'm feeling regretful. and so on. And connecting with all these levels is so important because that raises the quality of the conversation. Firstly, it is going to alter my response, right? If I reacted to what you say something hurtful, I react to it, we know where that conversation is going to go. If I'm a little more empathetic and I understand where it's coming from, I will respond in a little better manner, right? Hopefully I'm kind of appreciative of where you are, what's happening, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm still not mindful of my own limitations here, which is that when somebody says something that seems sensitive, I very easily get into a very permissive mode because I like being kind to people. Right? So again, it, the communication and the interaction is not going to be most transformational or most effective because, okay, I picked up your sort of emotional cues, but my own emotional flaws or my own emotional triggers are still at play. So if I can become aware that, hey, I know I'm getting drawn into this emotional drama because that's my tendency. If I'm just aware of that, maybe I'll respond differently. And hence we will move forward on that conversation in a very calm, assertive, authentic, meaningful way. And it'll become a transformational conversation. So that's kind of the three levels of three layers of listening that I've noticed. And again, in my coaching work, of course, this is so crucial because not only do I need to connect with my clients on what's happening with them, but also what's happening inside me. Because again, in a holistic way, Deepak, what is this conversation? What's the purpose of that conversation, on any conversation? Part of it is to, you know, move forward on what somebody else needs, et cetera, et cetera. But part of it is our own growth collectively. As you said, you know, from the podcast, you grow because you pick up some new nuggets or whatever. But as much as I am giving this sort of interview or whatever, I am learning, I'm growing myself. But only if I'm attuned to what's happening inside me, right? That's my journey of self-growth, which is happening in any process, in any conversation. So again, going back to your question of how does one do it, I think it goes back to, you know, it might sound like a broken record, Deepak, but it has to begin with deepening that self-awareness and doing it through creating that reflective practice, where we become more attuned to what's happening inside us at all times.
You know, one of the people I spoke to at the podcast, a lady called Jennifer Garvey Berger, she actually also talks about listening to our body for cues as well. You know, sometimes listening, we limit it to the world of grammar and English and language, but sometimes there are a lot of cues that we can get through our body in terms of how we feel, you know, how our wrist clenching, is our back stiffening and so on, which I thought was quite profound. In the way we listen to ourselves. Any nuance there, Rajiv, in terms of listening to ourselves? Anything that you've sort of gleaned through the years of this practice?
I think her point is totally valid. We can definitely pick it up in our physical sense as well, right? And physical sense is not just, one is the body, the other is the impact of sort of the emotions in the body, right? I mean, whether it's the stiffening of the back or, you know, you just, that sort of sinking feeling in your stomach, if you are feeling nervous or something like that, or, you know, or sometimes a punch in the gut if somebody said something that you really sort of were extremely uncomfortable with. And all of these, just being attuned to that. I think the other thing is, as I said, just the meditative nature is to be mindful all the time. And as we build that practice of mindfulness, we will naturally be just more aware. It just happens. It just, you know, it's like our it's like the radio, right? You tune it to a certain frequency and that's the music you're going to hear. And you tune it to a different frequency, you start hearing a different music. So with mindfulness meditation practice, you will alter the frequency at which you're listening. It'll just happen. It's not a conscious thing and so forth. It'll just happen. You'll just be in everyday moment, just more aware of what's happening inside you at different points in time. So
that's a wonderful metaphor. I guess one needs to be a minimum certain age to relate to that metaphor of tuning a radio. But it's so powerful with you. And you know, if I may stretch the metaphor further, there's a little bit of noise that you need to deal with as you move from one station to another, but the pursuit is worth it.
Good one. Yeah. You'll eventually get there. Yeah.
This is Deepak Jayaraman here. I love the nuance here in what Rajiv says. Very often we hear a lot of people talk about focusing on the emotion of the sender, but being aware of our emotions as we receive these signals significantly impacts the way we show up in a conversation, I guess. In the conversation, I referred to a piece of insight from Jennifer Gavi Berger. Here's Jennifer talking about listening to the signals from our bodies.
I mean, there's this way that many of us have been taught over centuries in our cultures and our societies that the mind is the great thing and the body is sort of the source of temptation or misleading data. And so we've learned to not trust or believe what our body tells us and really think that it's the mind that is the most glorious human achievement. Actually, when we look at sort of our psychobiology, our body is giving us signals all the time that our mind is making sense of very, very quickly and often reacting to without noticing that it was an embodied sensation that we were reacting to. So if we give someone, some studies that are great, like if you give somebody a shot of adrenaline and then you have them meet a stranger, depending on the gender of that stranger, they're either likely to be more drawn to that person as a love interest or more threatened by that person as a possible threat or enemy after this shot of adrenaline than they were under normal circumstances. And they tend to attribute that to the other person, right? And they don't attribute that to their bodies in any way. And so their body is giving them a signal, and then they're acting out of that signal without ever noticing that the signal happened. This is very dangerous, right? That we're responding to data by taking action in a way that's completely divorced from our seeing of the data in the first place. So we need to get much more in touch with what our body is telling us. I see leaders all the time, and you see there are studies about this as well. People who go into meetings hungry, because leaders I work with are very busy, and they hate all the ideas. Like, they hate all the ideas on the table. None of the ideas are quite right. Well, is this about the quality of the ideas, or is this about the fact that you didn't have time for lunch? Like, we don't tend to think, oh my goodness, I hate these ideas because I have no blood sugar and I have no creativity left. But actually, this is the way our bodies work. You know, there's fabulous studies of the thing that makes you most likely to get parole when you are in front of a parole board in prison is how close to a break the judges are when they look at your case. If you're right after they ate lunch or breakfast, then you're very likely to get paroled. If you're right before it's time for a break or a meal, you're very unlikely to get paroled. Now, this has nothing to do with the merits of these cases, right? Wow. This is completely because the judges are responding to a bodily sensation, but they don't know that they're responding to a bodily sensation. So they think they're responding logically. If we're more in touch with our bodies, we can avoid those mistakes.
If this topic is of interest, you might like the curated playlist on listening at the podcast. If you're finding the podcast of value, do take a moment to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or wherever else you consume this content. It will help us raise the bar in terms of the quality of conversations we're able to have at the podcast. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Rajiv Vij. Let me move to a different theme, Rajiv, transitioning from focusing on doing to being. Can you bring that to life for us? In the book, you give a couple of examples on what that means. You know, even in the case of delegation, you actually outline what a doing approach might be like and what a being approach could look like. Can you expand on that here?
Yeah, sure. I think, again, really powerful point here, Deepak, which is, firstly, let me just give you a sense of what this whole idea is, right? It's and particularly for your listeners, is you know, one subconscious belief that drives our life, and we are not even aware of it consciously, is the belief of doing, having, and being. And what I mean by that is, once I can do X, I will have Y, and I will be in a state of Z, right? Example, once I can work hard and get promoted, I will have more time, money, and flexibility, and I will be happier, right? That's how many of us have thought like that. The reality is, it's a mirage, because no sooner than you get promoted, you are busier than ever before. And in fact, now you're not necessarily as happy because you're already looking at the next promotion that you want. And we are in this vicious circle. And also, we've put our happiness, which is what we really wanted in the first place, on hold till such time we get this promotion, right? And in the and that promotion is not in our control, by the way, right? Or at least not fully in our control. So we are postponing our state of being, which is what we deeply desired, and getting busy with the doing. And the way to change that up and to rebalance it in our life is to start from place of being, which is to say, you know, what do I want? What kind of a person do I want to be? Oh, I want to be happy, let's say, for a minute. And then amplifying that, making sure we are paying attention to that in whatever we are doing. It's okay if you work hard and wish to get promoted, do that. But all along, don't put your happiness on hold. Make sure you are happy doing what you're doing. Make sure you are prioritizing things that make you happy, even in the work you're doing in the office, and so forth. And so applying that principle to many aspects of our professional and personal life. So for example, you brought about the point about delegation. So now typically what happens is, let's say I've become more aware that, you know, I should delegate more and I should be more empowering. But again, with busy life, typically what happens is we say, oh, this is such a busy phase. This is such an important project. Once I can get through it, I'm going to start empowering my team more. That's a typical thought process, right? Once let me do this, then I will be that way.
Hmm.
As against that, if only we could take a little break from that and say, you know what? What if I start being empowering now in this busy phase, this important project, et cetera, that I'm getting so attached to, so worked up about? If only I can start empowering now, actually, I won't even be that busy in this project. So we are starting from the place of being. So it's we can apply it to anything, right? Like people say, oh, you know, one of the feedback I get is I need to be more strategic, et cetera, et cetera. And again, the same thing, right? This is such an operationally heavy project and I need to really get into the weeds of it. This is crucial. Once this is done, you know, I'm going to start learning to step back and start being strategic. If only I can start building the muscle and start being more strategic now when I have this crucial project. This would be the best place to be strategic, in fact, because it's such an important project. So you want to be strategic about it. And then so forth. So one of the things I tell people is, you know, walk into the office, sometimes throw your things to do list and replace it with a things to be list. You decide the kind of person, the kind of leader you want to be. And try it for a week or two. And every day say, what kind of a person or a leader I want to be? And try being that way, and you'll be surprised how the doing will take care of itself. So for example, if you were to tell yourself, you know what, I'm going to be just more mindful as a leader, or I'm going to be more courageous, or I'm going to be more empowering, I'm going to be more strategic, or even in our personal life, I'm going to be more loving to my family, right? Rather than saying, I want to spend more time with my children, because you may spend more time, but if you are getting upset with them every 20 minutes, I don't know how good that quality of time was. You know, if you say I'm going to be more loving and more encouraging, more reassuring, or whatever is your need, that then you spend even 10 minutes instead of that 45 minutes, but they were loving moments. They'll be better spent than simply just, you know, the doing part.
So powerful, Rajiv. Thanks for sharing. Moving on, you talk about mindfulness, and you actually say it consists of two key tenets. One is being fully aware in the present and staying open to possibilities, you know? And I found it interesting because there's a lot of literature around being present, but it was interesting to hear you talk about staying open to all possibilities. Can you say more around what you have in mind here?
Yeah, I think, again, you're very insightful in picking these little variations of the standard things that I have. So, yeah, so mindfulness is all about, you know, being present and so forth. But, you know, one of the things that is a source of stress and also a distraction from our ability to be mindful is that we get attached to outcomes. So, oh, I need to get promoted this year, or we have to move to a new house this year, or COVID must end in the next 4 months, or whatever it may be, right? We all have little outcomes that we are trying to accomplish, but we get attached to them. And because we get attached to them, it becomes hard to be present and hard to be mindful, because our mind is somewhere else. As against that, if fundamentally, not only do we learn to engage with the present, but also fundamentally we become open to possibilities, of all possibilities in any situation, our ability to be more mindful will go up. So for example, if I were to be open to the possibility that, yeah, I'd like to get promoted this year, but maybe it'll happen this year, maybe not, I don't know, and it's okay. We want to move to a new house this summer, but hopefully it'll happen, but if not, that's okay too. And in this very moment, when I am wherever I am, if I'm open to the possibility, and the possibilities here are enormous, on the flip positive side as well, by the way, Deepak, it's not like, oh, I'm, you know, resigning to things, etc. No, both ways. So whatever, you know, I'm playing golf and I had two terrible holes. And now what is our mind telling us? One, we are not being present because we are thinking about the two holes we messed up. But also our mind is caught up in the fear of the fact that our score is going to be bad today, because we are not going to be able to make up those two bad holes. But if we stay open to possibilities, how do we know the next, how do we know the next seven holes or next 16 holes I'm not going to play out of my mind today? How do we know that? We don't know. Mm-hmm. Let's just stay present. Let's just stay open to possibilities and engage with the current moment in a mindful way. And let things unfold. Let's not assume anything. So I think not being caught up with predetermined notions, et cetera, and staying open to possibilities relaxes us emotionally and mentally, and that helps us be more mindful in a given moment.
Hmm. At some level, it's also linked to this notion of agility, right? Just sort of being agile every moment in terms of how the world opens up in front of us.
Yes. It's the adaptability, right? I mean, just being adaptable to that. And for that, we need to let go of our preconceived notions about stuff, you know, about people, about situations, about ourselves, about outcomes, and simply engage. Just know the process, right? If we stay open to possibilities, if we engage with anything in a mindful way, we are going to get the result that situation needed to create. It may be different from what I wanted, but it will be still a good effort towards whatever needs to transpire.
Hmm. And Rajiv, zooming out of the book and back to your journey as a coach over the last 15 plus years, one of the things I'm beginning to realize, I'm still early in my journey, it's 5 odd years, but I realize that, you know, if I sort of look at the situations where I feel I've made a difference, it's often more to do with the attitude of the coachee and, what the person I'm working with, the mindset that he or she brings to the relationship. If you were to talk a little bit about some of the coachees that stood out for you, without getting into the specifics, obviously, but what have you seen about people deriving value from the relationship, and what about them stands out for you?
Yeah, I think firstly, the key to me of any, you know, healthy coaching relationship is, number one, is the commitment to the process. And by commitment, I don't even mean that they have to be super excited about the coaching journey, and they could be positively inclined, even marginally, that's okay. But they're committed to giving it a real shot, and commitment not only in the physical time space, but also in the sense of, you know, mental bandwidth, because
for us to embrace change, change is difficult for any of us. And for us to embrace change, we have to step out of our comfort zone. And that requires a little bit of, you know, mental, emotional energy. And we have to have that in that moment. If we are just doing it while we are running around, you know, it's like you don't want to be trying to change the tire of a running car. It's just way too hard. So they have to be willing to sort of slow down, create the time and space for this. So that's number one. The second thing I would say is the comfort with candid sharing. I mean, it goes without saying. Obviously, you know, as a coach, you can only work with people with what they bring to the table. And the conversation is only as rich as, you know, what's out there. So commitment and comfort with sharing are the crucial thing. I would say besides that, from a personality point of view, I've now had the privilege of working with people with very diverse, you know, personalities. Some more like me and some completely unlike me. And there was also sometimes comfort in working with people who are a little bit more like me. You know, it's kind of, you can relate to them faster, you know, empathy, et cetera, comes easily. But people who are completely different, but that's my own personal journey, right? To be able to understand, to stay in that non-judgmental space and explore what is it that will help this person. Doesn't matter what their personality makeup, what will help this person move towards their goals. Right. And sometimes I may have grown more as a person, as a coach, working with people who are very dissimilar to me, because it has forced me to get out of my own comfort zone and explore and search in my own mind of questions that are going to help move this person forward. So I think those are some of the things I would say that I've seen, you know, people who are very open, very comfortable with sharing, very committed. Those are the people who seem to benefit the most.
This is Deepak Jayaraman here. If there's one thing I've learned over the last few years, I feel that Houston, I have a problem works better than Houston, he or she has a problem. I have found that there have been several instances where the investor comes to me and says the entrepreneur needs a coach, or the company comes to me and says this leader needs a coach. Unless the leader is really willing to open up and work on some of the themes, I realize that there's not much value for me to add. I had the opportunity to speak to Marshall Goldsmith, a legend in the field of coaching, and here's what he said about client selection.
The client I coach that I spent the least amount of time with improved the most. The client I spent the most amount of time with didn't improve at all. So I made a chart on one dimension, time spent with Coach Marshall Goldsmith, and the other dimension was called improvement. There seemed to be a clear negative correlation between spending time with me and getting better. Well, I thought, well, this is kind of a humbling chart. I go talk to my client who I spent the least amount of time with, improved the most, Alan Mulally. Alan was CEO of the year in the United States, unbelievable, probably the best leader in the world in the last 20 years, at least corporate leader. So I said, Alan, of all the people I coached, you improved the most and spent the least amount of time with you. I showed Alan my chart. I said, Alan, the way this chart looks, if you never met me, you'd really been good. So I said, Alan, what should I learn about coaching from you? He said, Marshall, you got one challenge, customer selection. You pick the right customer, you always win. You pick the wrong customer, you're never going to win. He said, don't make coaching about yourself and your own ego and how smart you think you are. Make it about the great people you work with and how proud you are of them. And he said, the CEO of Ford, my job wasn't that different. I don't design cars or build cars, sell cars. I get to have great people. And every day I tell myself, leadership's not about me, it's about them.
I think this is a healthy reminder for all of us coaches out there. It's not about me, it's about them. Let's now get back to the conversation with Rajiv Vij. And a related question here, Rajiv. I've been on this journey for 5 years, as I said. And it's a reasonably lonely pursuit, right? In the sense, I don't belong to a large firm where there's an opportunity of getting feedback. How have you thought about your journey, your development, your growth as you've gone through this journey of coaching?
Yeah, great question, actually. Excellent question, Deepak. Yeah. So for me, the biggest sort of anchor, if you like, is that meditative practice. That is my anchor,
So wherever I am, if I can, you know, get back to that, center myself, et cetera, it just starts to show me patterns of what's happening. And it could be anything. It could be, you know, I'm not being at my best with this client, or I wasn't fully present, or I'm feeling a little nervous before this presentation, or whatever it may be, right? All those things start to come to light, and then slowly I can keep working on those. And also that sort of reflective space and the practice slows down my own thought, flow of, you know, train of thought. And that allows me to also see in what way I'm being a good coach or less so. The other thing that I found helpful is attending training programs. You know, I mean, of late, not that many, but again, in the first maybe 5 years, I attended many programs on coaching. And then after that, maybe once every 2-3 years, I do. In fact, recently I attended a program about 6 months ago, and it was such so refreshing, right, to suddenly be back in a classroom, so to say, even though on Zoom, and with people from different backgrounds, and then you know sparring, and so many new ideas, and so many things you refresh and learn and relearn, and all of that. And the other thing I found useful was, I don't know if you are involved with the ICF, you know, the International Coach Federation, but they have a whole accreditation system. Mm-hmm. Initially I felt like, you know, it's fine, I'll do my bit. And as my coaching practice was actually taking off quite nicely, I was becoming a little complacent about it, to say, you know, things are fine, clients are finding it so useful, I mean, what mm-hmm. else do you want? But then, in fact, I was talking to another coach. I mean, it's funny actually, because to renew my coaching credential, I had to do 10 hours or I don't know how many, yeah, 10 hours, I think, of mentoring. And I was talking to this mentor, and she said that, you know, why are you just renewing your credential? You know, you seem to be coaching at a higher level. Why don't you aspire for a higher level of credential? And I said, you know, it's an effort, et cetera, et cetera. And she said, no, but, you know. And anyway, long story short, so I pursued that, and I learned so much through that process of, you know, going through the credentialing approach, because again, it just forces you to get back to basics. And, you know, we all develop not only blind spots, but also bad habits. You know, it's like, you know, I know you play tennis, right? So, you know, over a period of time, even if you have a good serve, you know, we pick up some little bad habits, something we start doing differently or wrongly or could be better. And you go to a coach and, you know, you could improve on it. And same thing I found from this credentialing approach was just tweaking a few things, you know, correcting a few things, et cetera. And it was a great learning experience. And it worked out well as well.
Lovely. Lovely. Rajiv, this podcast is titled Play to Potential. One question that I ask all the guests is what that phrase means to them.
Interesting. Yeah. Firstly, I want to compliment you, Deepak, on the quality of your podcast. I mean, you're doing a wonderful work with it. And most importantly, you know, it's impacting so many lives and helping so many people. So, I mean, hats off to you to put in the energy on such a voluntary basis towards this and to persevere with this passion of yours. So I think it says a lot about who you are and you know what you value in life. So my heartiest congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Play to potential. So for me, the typical dichotomy that I have seen in myself or with clients or other leaders and people is, particularly in the professional life, is people get caught up with the idea of exploring professional potential, right? It's all about, you know, I want to do this because what if I have the potential to generate this business? What if I have the potential to run the whole of Asia? What if I have the... So there is all of that. It's very focused on professional potential, and there's nothing wrong with that by itself. However, where it gets in the way is we confuse that with our life potential, with our human potential. What is this human life about, and what is possible in human life? What is even the purpose of human life? And in that, is simply pursuing professional potential and professional success the only thing that matters, or is there something bigger and larger than that? You know, what about, as we were talking about, you know, our own sort of this work on self-realization, on self-actualization, the work on becoming
more self-aware, the work on deepening the quality of unconditional love we have for others, at the least with our family members, right? We say we want to love them unconditionally, but do we love our family members unconditionally? And how do we value the progress on that versus, you know, growing my business 2x? Like who has decided which is more important, right? Or whether we have the gumption and the courage to pursue our life purpose, right? What is the value attached to that? Or our spiritual growth, or self-responsibility, or contribution to society, or, you know, climate change, or whatever it may be. So to me, the whole thing is, if we could only step back and simply determine what is this human life about and what's possible and what it's, I mean, again, I may be sounding a bit more spiritual here. What did we choose to take birth on this planet for, right? What is it that we wanted to really explore about ourselves? What are the things we needed to learn in this lifetime to grow as that eternal soul? So I think those are the questions that come to my mind when you talk of play to potential and looking at our own selves in multiple dimensions and multiple, you know, pieces or aspects of our being.
Hmm. So powerful, Rajiv. And if I may stick with it for a couple of minutes, one thing I notice is that when it comes to unlocking professional potential, there's often very visible metrics and we often get into this mode of, you know, managing what we measure. And when it comes to some of the other elements of life, it's quite intangible and often not very easy to measure. So what's your advice to people on ensuring that the measurability doesn't come in the way of focusing on what matters?
Yeah. I think, again, great point. Yeah, we do. I mean, particularly achievement-oriented people do gravitate to aspects of our life where progress is very measurable, professional success easily being one of the top things there, or even money or house or whatever. The thing is that, so besides the measurability, I think the other aspect of this is the external and internal sort of yardsticks, right? So again, when we don't have internal yardsticks, when we don't know ourselves very well, unless we have a deep awareness of ourselves, we easily fall prey to what's popular around us, whatever the society is telling us is important, right? So if we have deep self-awareness and we have clarity of our own purpose of what we think life should be about and what do I want my life to be about, and as long as I have my yardsticks on that, firstly, if you are internally focused on what is deeply important to you, I would say don't even worry about measurement. You know, it's like, how shall I say? You know, I find direction is more important than distance. You know, to the example of golf, you know, as an amateur, when you start golf, and I'm an amateur too, when you start golf, you get so excited when you can hit that driver, you know, 200 meters or whatever. It's just a thrill you get. And then you get caught up in how far am I hitting this driver, right? Or in tennis, how fast am I hitting that serve and so forth. But the fact is that as an amateur, as much as you are focused on that distance, on trying to drive that ball further, you do at least one third of the time, if not more, end up in some hazard, right? In the sand bunker or water or some trees or something else. As you become a little more experienced about it, you realize that actually the most fulfilling part of golf is to learn to be mindful, to be present, to open to possibilities, et cetera, et cetera. And for whatever it's worth, the score at the end of the day comes not from hitting the ball harder or further. It comes from hitting the ball straighter. If you can be on the fairway all along, you're just going to have a better score. It's as simple as that. So direction is, and as in golf, so in life, as direction is more important than distance. So if we are attuned to our inner being, are, you know, deeply self-aware of who we are, what we want our life to be about, and follow our own life purpose and commit to it, et cetera, et cetera, the distance won't matter at all. It's just going to be so fulfilling already. And then if you want to put some markers, put holistic markers across all dimensions of your life, whatever you value, right? Whether it is the love in your family to, you know, the deep friendships you have, to how you want to give back to society, to your own spiritual growth, to your emotional well-being. I mean, most of these things are very difficult to measure, but you can put your own personal, you know, sort of scorecard if you like, and you can review it from time to time. But as I said, the most important thing beyond the measure is, are you following your life's purpose? You know, if you're doing that, I think you're already in a very significant minority on the planet.
Rajiv, really, really powerful conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your insights. Thanks a lot.
No, my pleasure entirely, Deepak. I love the conversation. And again, you're doing a great job, and please keep that going. And it was a real pleasure, and I really enjoyed your powerful and insightful questions.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. I hope you found the conversation purposeful. A couple of messages before we wrap up. Do look out for our highlights from 2021, where we will feature the 10 most impactful nuggets from across the various conversations we had in 2021. We'll be publishing this in the next couple of weeks. If you're interested in receiving short 2-minute extracts of wisdom from the podcast, served up once or twice a week, do consider signing up by sending a WhatsApp message at +91 85914 52129. I repeat, the number is +91 85914 52129. Here, we share short extracts across the various guests we've had at the podcast. Do also rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you consume the content. It might seem like a repetitive ask, but trust me, it makes a big difference in people discovering this podcast amidst a lot of noise out there given the boom in the podcast supply in India and around the world in the last few months. It also helps us attract good quality speakers as we move forward. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the advisory work I do, you could just visit playtopotential.com. That's PlayToPotential.com. Thank you, and look forward to have you tune into one of the subsequent conversations of the podcast. Bye now.